Welcome to the Trauma Informed Lens podcast. Each week, Matt, Kurt, Jerry, and the occasional special guest explore how the trauma informed paradigm challenges traditional beliefs and approaches concerning a wide variety of areas. This podcast addresses psychological trauma in an educational manner and is not designed to replace mental health treatment. If anything in this podcast makes you feel uncomfortable or anxious, please talk to a mental health professional.
Welcome, friends, to episode 91 of the Trauma Informed Lens podcast. I'm back here with Jared today, continuing our big idea series. Today, we're going to talk about love. And if you're just joining us for the first time or haven't joined us for a while, we're sort of taking a fun summer, lighter reading sort of thing, though we're talking a lot about neurobiology and trauma still. And we're using John Haidt's book, The Happiness Hypothesis, to sort of guide our discussion. If you haven't or you're not reading the book along with us, I've been told we're doing a good job of keeping people up to date on what we're reading, and they're not losing much if they're just listening to us. So I really like the book. If you want to pick it up, I think it's a good read, but you'll be fine if you haven't read the chapter we're talking about as well. So before we jump into love, Jerry, we always start out with the bright, shiny objects of the week. Anything you're thinking about this week, my friend?
So I just got back from a little vacation in Minnesota. And we were up in a small town, Nisswa, and every year, every week, summer, they do turtle races. But what was interesting is there were three and four generations of people who, in this town, that had brought their, now are bringing their grandchildren to the turtle races. And so, you know, the turtle races were, from my perspective, not that interesting. But what was interesting is how coming together as a community for such an event and social event really brightens people's affect. People feel connected. They seem to have fun. And so these small little town events are really, I think, very important rituals to have where you get out of your house. And I know you have over by you, you have your street fairs or whatever. Those rituals of getting out and meeting your neighbors and feeling connected are really, really important. You know, and people do it differently in different parts of the country, but it's an important part of being part of a community.
Absolutely. And one of the things, I also spent some time at a lake as well. And funny how that was timed, that we were both at Midwestern lakes around the same time. One of the things that I realized living out west, I'm just happy we don't have all the mosquitoes that I grew up with in the Midwest. But I got to hang out with my nephews who, one just is getting into middle school and one's in those fourth grade, sort of fifth grade age group. And boy, did they wear me out. It was a lot of fun to be, I am definitely the fun Uncle Matt. My birthday gifts are usually like fart machines and other things. Jerry and I would really like, and also middle school fourth graders like as well. I'm not sure if my sister appreciates my gifts, but it was just a lot of fun to hang out with that level of energy. And man, was I exhausted. So just say my bright, shiny object is to all the parents out there who have that age kid and how you keep up with them, I have no idea. I'm still sore 5-6 days later from hanging out with my nephews. But it just was a great time to spend with my family, fun to get on the inner tube, the jet ski, and it was just a great time. So a good introduction for us after family time to talk about this chapter, Jerry. So one of the things that, and man, I was hoping I could get Kurt on this topic, but I guess I got to let him I gotta let him slide because he's still really busy this summer. But the idea that I never heard about of baby farms coming out of behavioral science, that there was this theory of really love had nothing really to do with how to raise a healthy child. And I think looking back as somebody who was, you know, grew up professionally, so to speak, in a time where we already had attachment theory, it always had been a part of my intro to psych classes and all that. But I was just like a little bit, you know, taken back by the fact that at one time the science of the day in psychology really was advocating for, you know, in many ways, taking children and raising them in a scientific environment that didn't have a whole lot of love, interaction, kindness. I remember my mom talking about how when she was raised, you know, breastfeeding was really in some ways not practiced all that much, that there was kind of taboo. And I kind of saw some of this coming out in this science. So one of the things I want to get to is how attachment theory came out of this philosophy, because that's the part of the history I didn't know and find fascinating. But Jerry, I know you got a few years of sort of experience in psychology before I got involved in my learning. I just kind of wanted to get your thoughts on sort of what you've seen in your sort of lifetime, but also professional, of how parenting and love has developed sort of in a historical context with your career.
So, you know, being trained initially in psychoanalysis and dynamic theory, the important pieces were internal conflicts, mm-hmm. right? And you have to remember the initial models weren't really looking at, attachment disruption and those types of things. They would look at more, in some ways, neuroses. Mm-hmm. People who in some ways had an incredible amount of anxiety and whatever. So in psychoanalysis, they really looked at this intra-psychic conflict. So what was actually happening in your world wasn't as significant of what was going on inside of you and the conflicts between, you know, your impulses and your sexual and aggressive impulses and kind of managing those things. And they had a very unique language, and it really wasn't in some ways embedded in a science at the time. Mm-hmm. It was a philosophy. Psychology really came out of a philosophy. And I think that, if you read Sigmund Freud, he eventually talked about that he was a physician, and he was and thought that eventually we would understand these things from a biological perspective, kind of looking at that. And then you had issues of, in the United States, of behaviorism. And behaviorism came out of, in some ways, trying to make psychology a science of what can we measure. If we can't measure it, it doesn't exist. And really in reaction to psychoanalysis. So you had these two kind of models that kind of looking at, and you had other models at the time, you know, that were looking at, William Reich kind of looking at the body, and you had, Pierre Genet trying to understand trauma, but they weren't the dominant kinds of models that you were looking at. And then you had, here in the United States, you had really Harlow looking at rhesus monkeys, mm-hmm. Trying to understand it. And it's interesting, simultaneously in England, you had Bowlby kind of looking at it. And, you know, that was following really this war, and that the were in World War II and kids being separated from their parents. And he ended up kind of being at a residential treatment center. for more or less, you know, that's not what they called them at the time, but really wanting to kind of understand. And he grew up in a boarding school. So you see there, in some ways, their own history drives them to kind of think about the world in a different way. But how hard it is to kind of challenge an existing view, mm-hmm. right? How much we cling to this is the way, and you have to actually go out of your way to prove to me that something. And as we read this book, it's like you know, it's on attachment, and I think he's presenting us all this history, and he doesn't really do a very good job of reviewing the history. Goes through it pretty quickly, but he can't let go of his gene theory, man. Right? Love this, because it's very hard for us to shift our internal models. We're trying to plug in new information into what we already know.
Yeah.
And I think if you think about what Bowlby was trying to do and what, you know, Harlow was trying to do, and at the time, one of Harlow's students was, you know, Maslow. Mm-hmm. Another of his students was Stephen Sumi, who still kind of works at the National Institute of Mental Health, working with rhesus monkeys, looking at epigenetic factors that are kind of managing some of these kinds of things. So, you know, the rhesus monkey, although it doesn't have as much in common with us as, say, a chimpanzee, still 95% of their genes are incompatible with ours.
Yeah.
So you can kind of look at some of those types of things. So, you know, for me growing up, I really struggled with, I was initially looking at this psychoanalysis and thinking, you know, people don't live in their internal world. They interact with people. Mm-hmm. And then the family therapy systems came along, and you had attachment, but then you're kind of looking at, so how does your family influence you in kind of looking at that way? And then attachment theory, kind of looking at how those early relational interactions. But now we have neuroscience that tells us not only are they seeking proximity for protection, but really our brains and physiology are adapting in the context of those relationships.
Yeah.
So new information enhances those, and how trauma impacts that development.
Yeah.
But it took, you know, the ACE studies is what, 20 years old, right? How long it takes for people to, in some ways, integrate new science into the way they actually interact with in their work.
Yeah, and one of the things that I, you know, that I didn't get in sort of my history of psychology books, either in my master's program or undergrad, was really what I thought fascinating is really some of this initial research was trying to kind of, in many ways, create this idea of a baby farm, of what would be the ideal situation to raise monkeys to gain insight to how would we apply these to human beings. And I think, you know, I found this just fascinating is they were trying to kind of prove one thing, but found something very different. And like, you know, and it always kind of broke my heart, these pictures, because, you know, as someone who, you know, I would call myself an advocate, but I believe in animal rights. Sometimes the things we do to get our data is just kind of hard for me to stomach. And that picture stuck with me about that baby rhesus monkey, which is one of the cutest things on the face of the earth. Just adorable little baby monkey sort of grabbing on to this wire thing with cloth on it and choosing the cloth one versus the one with milk. And just kind of how they got to this is they tried to raise these children in these idealized scenarios, but because they took them away from their parents at a very early age, they were very sick, and they were actually scientifically no use because they were so their development was so maladaptive, so to speak, that they had, I guess maladaptive is probably the wrong word because they adapted to the environment they were in, but they couldn't use these monkeys because socially they couldn't then interact with the group. And I the piece I didn't get before this chapter, while he does go over the history really quickly, is they were kind of trying to prove, they didn't set out to disprove Watson. They were in many ways trying to add detail to support his theories and then found something incredibly different. And I love when science tries to do one thing and then accidentally in some ways discovers a whole new arena of study. And I just thought that little piece of it really added a lot to my understanding about the history of attachment.
Yeah, and you know, the whole research around attachment came out of observing animals, right? And you look at Darwin, who looks at the issue of emotions in animals, and understanding that we are born with something basic emotions that animals also experience, to kind of looking at that piece. And so, you know, there's animal studies where we're manipulating them, but there's animal studies in which we're observing them. You know, and it's very hard when you read history. I mean, you think about someone like Lorenz. When you read history, I mean, this guy was, I mean, his idol was Hitler.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, so some of these guys in some ways are really finding new things, but in their own lives, they struggle with other types of issues. So you don't want to read too much history into and understand some of this stuff to kind of look at that. But I think what's important is this concept of love. Mm-hmm. Is that it's a very difficult thinking about love when you were coming from a model in which you were supposed to be a blank screen. Mm-hmm. You were supposed to sit behind and not in some ways have any relationship with your client. Yeah. Or a true behavior original model was, I'm just reinforcing and consequenting, and if you give me any child that can raise them to be anything I want, that really it's not the relationship at all.
Yeah.
Kind of looking at that is that this concept of relational connectedness wasn't really part of the psychology of the day.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just the attachment theory, but it's really understanding that we have today that really growth, development, and healing takes place in the context of a relational interaction.
Right.
Right? Which is foreign in these two models.
Absolutely. And that's where, you know, I think really growing up with attachment as part of my growing up professionally with that being a knowledge, you know, I started out with that piece, and then the family systems therapy was big in my graduate work. You know, and so for folks that might not be as familiar, because I think sometimes the other thing that I find interesting, and I don't know, Jerry, you I know you've done decades of reading beyond what I've read, but sometimes we just throw attachment out there. Yep, it exists, and you can find in one of these three areas. But I really thought, you know, within this, the strange situation studies as well, is trying to find, you know, how this parent-child interaction sort of plays out throughout life. And one of the things in my trainings that I try to do, because I usually don't have a ton of time to go into attachment unless I have two or three days with folks to really dive into it, is really setting up that initial parent-child relationship, as I like to say, really in many ways sets a template for how you look at relationships throughout your life. So there is that social learning piece in there. There is that big part. But really, and he mentions in the book pretty quickly, but if you have sort of an aloof parent, that the child will more often than not have, you know, sort of that avoidant style where they may, once they kind of get, and I saw this a lot in the kids that we worked with, is sometimes you got too close to them. And just when you think professionally you're having this great breakthrough, all of a sudden there's an explosion of behavior because they're not ready to feel that close. That the trust can be scary for them, or that anxious attachment that can happen as well, which oftentimes has similar sort of testing for behavior. So, you know, I always found it really fascinating that we throw people sort of, oh, you have an avoidant or an anxious, or even, he doesn't mention this, but we talk a lot about in trauma, the disorganized attachment. But then, you know, I think it's also, I always try to put in there, just like with trauma is not a life sentence. There's some good research out there that attachment is not a life sentence as well. And so I just kind of like, how do you see, because a lot of times I know in our careers, we get the child or the adolescent, many times after years, if not 13, 14 years, when they've been in this attachment relationship. And I just kind of wonder from a programmatic perspective, how has this importance of that initial relationship and the importance of relationships informed how you look at setting up programs and interventions for folks?
So, you know, there's great research. I mean, Alan Struth, one of the Minnesota longitudinal studies, looked at this concept of attachment with kids for like 42 years, understanding how early relational interactions impacts. But it's important to understand that it's not just what happens to you as a child dictates what happens to you as an adult. But when we're in a relationship with somebody who's sensitive, attentive, attuned, and responsive, we begin to see human relationships as a resource. So we create a positive association to them. However, when our parents or caregivers, whoever that may be, most of the time our parents are, right, struggle with connectedness, the child has to in some ways figure out how to adapt to them in order to get cared for. Mm-hmm. So for a parent who can't tolerate closeness, a child has to down-regulate their attachment behaviors, the crying and seeking, and almost in some ways have an internal mantra that I can do this on my own. Yeah. I don't really need you, right? Or the child who grows up with a parent who is inconsistent and is not there, and they have to cling and be there and they grow up with this internal mantra, I'm not enough, mm-hmm. right? So that internal experience is being recorded, remembered, not at a cognitive level at first, but at a implicit procedural memory. This is how you interact in order to get your needs met, right? It's not a conscious level. Later on, as you go out into, say, school, the same situation that happens. So if I'm a child with a secure attachment, and I come up to you and I say, do you want to play? And you say no. In my mind's eye, I go, well, he doesn't want to play. I'll go get somebody else to play. But if I've had this attachment disruption, I'm going to interpret that situation very differently. And I'm going to go, well, if you don't want to play, then I don't need you. I'm going to go play by myself and isolate. So now it gets reinforced by the way I behave. And so my new experiences get filtered through my past experiences to kind of do it. So that in a way, the brain could change throughout our lives and we could form new attachments. And there's even a thing that in a literature that's called an earned secure attachment. That we can make a connection with another human being, a spouse or a friend or a parent of another friend. And we can, because of their interaction with us, we can actually develop a secure attachment with them. So it's not a, just like genes are not your destiny, attachment isn't either, but it, if you understand attachment, it in some ways puts us at risk for future kinds of experiences that reinforce those experiences.
Yeah.
So that's one of the issues. The other issue really is when we're in treatment, is the therapist's goal really is to create a secure connectedness, mm-hmm. right? So I don't want to be too detached, and I don't want to be intrusive, right? So I want to be responsive. So when we're setting up programs, how do we set up programs in a way that allows our clients really to engage in what they have an internal representation of who we are, right? You're a caregiver. You have resources. They're going to approach us based on their history. If Kurt was on, they'd call it a learning history, right? Yeah. Right. But they approach us. If somebody else is, it's a memory. It's a memory of what it was like to get your needs met. So that you as a therapist or a case manager, you don't want to react to what they're expecting you to be, right? You want to be present and allow them to come in when they need to and take distance when they need to. You want to be in some ways responsive. So you want to be non-directive at times when they're working on something or they're needing something, but also at times when you know they need to do something, you can in some ways direct it. And then when they engage, you go back to non-direct. So it isn't I'm directive or I'm not non-directive. It's what does this client in front of me need at this particular time? Because trauma is I'm either going to get flooded by trauma, right? Traumatic memories, or I'm going to avoid them. So if we totally let the client do whatever they want, nothing's ever going to change. Right? So if I come in and I just try to have a relationship with you, eventually you're going to organize me to have a relationship based on your expectations. But if I have a model of what a secure attachment looks like, what the internal, I can eventually help you have a different experience in this relationship. Right? And we can create a different narrative.
Yeah.
That we kind of do it. So when you look at attachment history and you look at the initial work that was done, it was done on children, mm-hmm. right? But then you look at later on Mary Main and her cohort and later on going is understanding. So what does those behaviors look like as an adult? And what is the, instead of it happening in this interactional process, it's now happening at the level of a representation. Is I have an internal representation of what relationships are like, and now I'm basing my behavior on an internal model, which you would talk about as the internal working model, right? And so when we get to adults, I really want to understand what's their model that they're bringing to this, right? How are they thinking about the relationship? Who do they think I am and what kind of distortions or in some ways projections do they put on me based on their history of people that they've dealt with in the system or people they dealt with, right? That's at the level when you're working with adults. When you're working with children, you're watching this interactional process. Very different. So when we're in a treatment center and you're trying to build a program, you have to take into account not only the attachment history of the clients you're working with, but what's the attachment history of the staff that are working with them?
Yeah.
right? And how do I, in my supervisory relationship, try to create a secure, safe, secure relationship with my staff so that they can have a different experience, right? And some of your staff come in and they already have a secure relationship. Mm-hmm. But some of your staff are somewhat avoidant, and some of them are somewhat, you know, they have, you know, hopefully we're not dealing with too many staff with a disorganized attachment to kind of look at. But if we are, one of the things about disorganized attachment is that they can change pretty quickly in a healthy relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so that you build your program with an awareness of how do I have my staff see the child's behavioral interplay, it's not about me, it's about what they bring, but it's going to organize me.
Yeah.
If I'm not in some ways intentional about how to be with this child.
Yeah.
Right? They're going to, in some ways, and that when our brains in some ways run into something that we're not expecting. So if I'm screaming and I'm yelling, and then I have a staff respond to their internal state of how frustrating this must be for you, their internal model is, this doesn't fit with what I'm expecting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when change happens.
Yeah. Yeah, and I thought one of the things, you know, that I think one of the more fascinating pieces, I think this was from Bloom's work, but I'd have to go back, is that there was some research done, which I found so, it just let me put a little knowledge on what I experienced, is a lot of times, whether they're kids or adults, and kids, once I got this research, I really looked for it, because I found it all the time, is that they can get the other person outside, you're not their parent, but they get the professional or the teacher to treat them in a way that mirrors the parent, their parent, their relationship with their parents. So someone with an avoidant, anxious, or even disorganized attachment, because they feel in some ways, and I think this is hard for somebody that grew up with a secure attachment to connect with, but they feel more comfortable in a relationship that mirrors that parent-child relationship. So I would often see staff, and I was guilty of this as well, start to treat children pretty harshly, to maybe withdraw empathetically. And there's a lot going on in that dynamic, but I thought it was very powerful to learn that these folks, again, it's not an intentional act. It's unconscious, implicit. But they get really skilled at getting people to treat them in a way that they feel comfortable. So it took a while for me to understand that, hey, I was just told build trust, build safety. And I would do that because I thought that was the most, you know, clinically relationships, the number one predictor of outcomes. And for a lot of the traumatized kids that I worked with in my career, me trying to kind of get them to be in a close, intimate relationship with me and disclose stuff, they weren't ready for that right away. I think I got too close too quick, because that's kind of what I was trained to do. And I thought that research that, hey, they come in with this template, and if you force it too early, they'll frustrate you. They might get, I've seen staff yell at good staff, get so frustrated they might yell at a kid. And in some ways, it recreates that attachment template where that meets the kid's expectations of what a relationship with somebody with power over you is supposed to be. And that was just really insightful for me to help understand some of my own frustration is, hey, I care. Why can't I connect through some of this stuff? And I thought that was a really interesting little nugget of research that they found. I believe they were studying residential care when they came across that discovery.
So I want to shift the lens on that a little bit.
Yeah.
Right? So your interpretation of what it is they were acting in a way to recreate their experience.
Yeah.
one way to think about that a little differently is that the way that they had to survive, not having somebody sensitive and responsive and caring for them, is that they had to develop strategies to manage their pain, to manage their distress, because they couldn't rely on their caregiver to be in a co-regulating space with them. So they ended up having to manage it on their own. And so their adaptation really is a pain management strategy. So when you engage in their relationship, try to engage in a relationship with them, is you're asking them to give up their pain management strategy, which means that they have to be able to be in a place to have trust that you're going to co-regulate them. But that's not their internal experience, right? So their behavior is really about them trying to manage this internal state, which creates an internal state for you to manage. Yeah. You then manage it based on what you try to do. So if you're somebody who sought proximity to, as a way of managing your distress, you're going to try to seek proximity to this kid because not because it's what this kid needs, because you're in distress and you're trying to kind of do it, or maybe you distance yourself. But working with these populations, they're not in there trying to recreate anything with you. They're trying to cope.
Right.
And this is what they've learned how to cope with, to kind of look at that. Right? And so they're going to create a similar internal state in you that they've had to deal with. Now, when you try to get connected with them, their experience of that is you're the threatening attachment figure that disappointed them, and you kind of did, right? And so in a way, you're saying they're recreating the dynamic. And what I'm going to say is the dynamic gets created by relational. You have to own your piece of creating this part. Instead of thinking they're redoing it, is how am I... what's happening inside of me that's causing me to, and then I can then figure out what's the strategy I need to manage myself. So things don't happen one way in relationships. So my job really as a supervisor is really to help my staff look at what they're feeling when they're with these kids, and then how do I help you develop healthy internal models, theories, or techniques, or whatever it is you need to have in order to tolerate that. So we let this kid come and go to kind of looking at that. But oftentimes we blame the kid for recreating the experience when it isn't just a kid. The kid is just doing their part in the process.
Yeah, great point.
Or the adult is just doing their part.
Yeah.
How do we play a part in changing it rather than reenacting it?
Yeah. Absolutely. And that really, one of the pieces that and you brought this up a couple times, and I really want to, because the end of this chapter talks about love and all that fun stuff. But the thing that I take away from what you're saying, and again, kind of that final part of the chapter, was that this idea, and I think it's, in some ways, I think it's the next term gets so connected to the parent and the child that it struggles to translate. And I think that's a really unfortunate thing, is the idea of a secure base and really a healthy parent-child relationship. I always like, again, if I have a few minutes to describe it, is the parent is that safe place. And the child learns from a very young age that gradually they learn to explore the world with more and more confidence because they know mom, dad, the caregiver is going to be there for them. They have that security, they have that safety. So that might just be crawling into the next room at first. That might be eventually going to preschool. That might allow to stay with the babysitter and not freak out. So there's this idea of this secure base. One of the things I wish we could talk about, because I believe I see this, is that secure bases get replicated throughout our life. I would call it traumatic, and I use that word with all its implications. Previous employment situations before you became my supervisor, Jerry. And I remember, and again, none of this was intentional, and you called me out on it one day, and I had that kind of awakening, is that even though I had kind of really secure, and I was dating my wife now, Sarah, who's been the best amazing person in my life, and I have this amazing connection with. So personally, I had this great secure relationship with a romantic partner, but because I had a negative and again, I would call it traumatic relationship at a previous work environment, it was impossible for me initially to trust you. And if anybody ever meets Jerry, you know he's the most kind, trustworthy person you could ever meet. But again, I think when we talk about the supervisor-supervisee relationship, you know, the data really supports that if I can establish trust with my immediate supervisor, and obviously my coworkers and peers play into this as well, that gives me the ability to take healthy risks, to be innovative, to think outside the box, so to speak. I know that being in a healthy marriage with a secure, what I would call secure base with my wife, even though we mutually give that to each other, I get to go explore and give so much energy professionally because I know my wife is supportive of that. So I think we struggle to use this because, you know, a supervisor at work is not your parent, you know, and so we have to be careful with how the language translates. But at least in my experience, Jerry, that secure base is so important, and we kind of replicate that at least throughout different life experiences. And obviously it's different than the parent-child relationship, but there's so much similar characteristics there that I see with romantic partners, with employment situations, and other things as well. And I would love to kind of wrap up with kind of the concept of, how do you see that idea of a secure base? Do you see a transitioning outside childhood? And kind of your thoughts on my kind of insight that we do try to recreate that throughout our lives.
So what is your question?
do you see similarities in that secure base, at least characteristic-wise, playing out in other parts, like when you talk about supervisor-supervisee relationships or other parts of your life? Do you think we could take that word and use that at least concept to talk about what a staff would need to be creative, take healthy risks in their environment later on in life as well?
So when you look at the theory of attachment, Charlie Zenon from down in Tulane has this circular security model that kind of look at that. But there's a secure base, which means that you have a sense of security that you feel safe and that I'm encouraging you to go out and explore to kind of do it. But there's the other part, which is the safe haven, which is when things get too hard or something happens, you can come back mm-hmm. and get refueled and get, you feel like I can, this is a place I can come back and be cared for. Kind of look at that, right? And so in a way, you have to both care and dare. I got to care for you, but dare you to go beyond what you think you're capable of doing, right? And so there's a challenging part to the supervision. Mm-hmm. And there's a caring part to the supervision. They're both very, very real. And that when I'm thinking about being a supervisor, I'm thinking about how do I get you to be functioning from the most complex part of your brain where you're able to process things, to reflect on your own experience, reflect on the problem that you're dealing, and to come up with innovative solutions to what you're dealing with, as opposed to being in a defensive state where you're going to be automatic and reactive. and you come in and you say, here's the rules and this is what has to happen, right? You're not really thinking at that particular point. And so in a way, my job as your supervisor is to create enough safety and security for you that, you know, if you feel like something happened in our relationship that you could challenge me, mm-hmm. you could get angry at me, or you can, right? Is that what ended up happening in your relationship? Something happened in that relationship that triggered something in you. Mm-hmm. It wasn't all your past supervisor. It was something happened where you felt something that was really hard to manage, but you didn't feel safe enough to go back or reinforced enough to go back and say, I'm really struggling with this. Can we work this out? And as a supervisor, I may still say, you know, this is what we need to be doing. But in doing that, I validate, but I'm really sorry this is causing you so much distress. What can I do to help support you to kind of looking at that, right? There's times as an administrator or that we're having to make cuts based on money, that we're having to come, is that, but I have to be aware that that's creating feelings in you, and my job is to help you manage those feelings. Mm-hmm. That's the safe haven. But then I've got to go back and say, now that we've worked on this, how are you going to go back and help your staff deal with this? That's the secure base, mm-hmm. right? So that if you get stuck not having a place to deal with it, it becomes toxic not only for you, but all those other people that you're supposed to be caring for, yeah. right? Which is that parallel process. Mm-hmm. So that when I think about my relationship to you, is I want to give to you what I want you to give to your staff, what I want them to give to our clients.
Yeah.
That's really what I think. And that is a bit of reality, Matt, that when you're in business, sometimes you got to do really hard things. But it also is okay for you, one is to be angry about that, and two is to feel some sense of loss about that. And this is a place that you can come and we could talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whatever, whoever. Now I want you to go back and think about how you're going to do that with the people below you to kind of
know.
So that we begin to have healthy relational interactions so that our clients are less likely to cause that reenactment. If my staff feel contained and cared for, then if they're really angry, but they have no place to go, this client's going to come in and get them angry, and they're going to go, okay, now I have power and control. I can use it where I couldn't use it before. So as an organization, you're constantly, and I forget the gentleman's name that wrote the book on attachment thing, but he said you got to both care for your staff, but dare them to be excellent.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it reminds me of things you've said too, when we've kind of talked about the window of tolerance and what people is that what once we have that, what, whether we're doing clinical work or I would say, again, I think this translates a lot too. You know, once we get some relational safety and trust is to push people, right? To challenge people, to get them to look at different things. And I think a lot of times, unfortunately, sometimes we tell people to do things without that relational foundation built, which then causes a lot of conflict. But I think how that power of that relationship, again, safety, trust, all that stuff creates the foundation for, again, a word that just keeps coming up to me in the trauma literature is healthy risk-taking is, you know, maybe I will bring a new idea up in a meeting. Maybe a client who struggled with domestic violence will take the risk to get back and start to date again. You know, all these, a kid might try to trust or to try to do an academic assignment again and take that risk of failure as well. And so, you know, I just find it fascinating to however old we are, it seems like if we got someone in our life that cares about us and gives us that trust and safety, how we push ourselves beyond ourselves, wherever we're at, whether that's struggling to recover from trauma and horrific experiences, or whether that's trying to build the best organization or deliver the best care possible, that there just seems to be a beautiful connection to trust, safety, interrelationally allows us to, in many ways, challenge ourselves to be better than we are today.
Right. And so that, you know, the content for all of us across our agencies or across the work that you're doing may change, right? Mm-hmm. It may change. I'm dealing with abused and neglected children, or I'm dealing with homeless population, or I'm dealing with domestic violence. Mm-hmm. So the content changes, but the relational interactions are very similar in that this person, as you talked about, I had this bad experience as a supervisor, is coming in with a template of I can't trust right now because I don't want to be vulnerable. And my strategy is how I'm managing that. Yeah. If I can, in some ways, be present with that with you and get you to talk to me about, so it's really hard, instead of saying, well, I didn't do anything and you're safe here and, you know, I'm a good supervisor and what is, tell me a little bit about what it was like for you to be with that kind of supervisor.
Yeah.
In that process, we're beginning to change the interaction.
Yeah.
Right? Absolutely. In that process, so that you have to, as a provider of care, however that looks, have to think about how can I approach this and create a sense of security and safety for the person that I'm working with, whether that be an employee, whether that be a client, or whether that be with somebody who's coming to your agency as a, say, for example, a case manager or a caseworker. What can I do to have them feel heard, seen, and valued, and then they'll be way more open to engaging in this back and forth interaction in which we can collectively and collaboratively problem solve.
Great. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that's a great way to wrap up this.
Now, do I love them? Well, that's a different issue. Some of them, yeah. I do.
Yeah.
Right? But what I could say is I love the process of going through this with people.
Right. Absolutely. Right?
That's the important piece is that as a therapist, as a case manager, instead of focusing on this person is angry at me, can you love the process that you're engaged in?
Yeah. Yep, and just realizing, I think so much we get so caught up in getting X, Y, and Z done. And I always tell people, you've got to get X, Y, and Z done. But I believe in the business research is really caught up with this in the years. I'd say in the last 10, 15 years of my reading, at least, is, hey, now we know is the stronger the relationship is, the stronger the social health of the organization's culture, the better X, Y, and Z will get done. And so there's just, I love how the research is kind of filling in some of these blanks as well. So
if you look at good salesmen or saleswomen, whatever, yeah, you want to look at them, they're very good at creating a sense of distress in you.
Yeah.
Right? Is like, oh, you know, if you don't buy these fire alarms, your house is going to burn to the ground and they're not going to be, right? But I now have a product to sell you to make you feel safe.
Yeah.
Right? Is that they don't use this language, but they're very good at manipulating these things with us.
Yeah.
Which is why we as a capitalistic society, when we get generated fear all the time in our thing, we're much likely to go out and buy something.
Yeah.
Right? What we should do instead of buying something is find out how to reconnect with something, which is how I started this with the turtle races in the small little town, is those connectednesses with your community, connectedness in your organization, connectedness in your family is what is the anesthetic that helps us to manage the stress that we feel in our daily lives.
Yeah. Perfect way to end it. Great conversation, Jerry. So we'll continue next time with our exploration of the happiness hypothesis. Jerry, as always, thanks so much. Thanks, everybody, for listening. As always, you can find show notes, discussion questions at traumainformedlens.org. And everybody have a good week, and we'll see you next week.
Adios.